So today we're going to talk about, I don't think we've spoken about it in the year and a half that I've been giving this year. Shailas related to skulas. They don't train you for this in any smicha program that I know of. So I want to share with you three actual questions that came my way, and we'll just give like one sort of general mahalik as an answer to all three questions. One question I got about 3.5 years ago, I got the following email. I dug up the email. I'll just tell you the story. Essentially, a guy had been married for 6 months, and he told me that his wife's kala teacher gave his wife a book that about all sorts of good, nice minhagim to observe. And one of the things that it said in the book is there's a minuk tov to give tzedakah each time they have tashma shamita. He wasn't clear before, after, I don't think it was during, but you know, each time they have tashma shamita. So he broke a $20 bill and would give $1 each time. But it was getting more and more difficult to do because he didn't always have small change and he had just lost his job, so to give larger amounts was becoming somewhat difficult. So he wanted to know, does he need to be Matir Neder? And if he does need to be Matir Neder, does he have to be Mefarit the Neder? Because that could be a little embarrassing. And is there anything to such a minuk? The Sefer said, such a minuk tov, to give tzedakah every time they have tashma shamita. So that was question number one. Question number two, school related, I just got this week. This was what got me thinking along these lines. I got the following email. Rabbi Leibowitz, I hope this email finds you well. Or Hashem, it did. I very much, blah, 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 why you Torah, blah, 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 blah. Here we go. My friend recently had a vart, her own, and there's a lot of explanatory parentheses over here, had a vart, her own, and ran over to us as we were leaving. This is from a woman. So she says, my friend ran over to us as we were leaving, saying she had a present for us. Holding a bag, she hands each of us a kitchen knife, parentheses, in a slipcase so that it wasn't hazardous, decorated with beads, parentheses, because it was a present, not because it had to do with the skula, the meaning of the beads. She then explained, parentheses, name of Chassan, and his friends heard of this skula where you buy a knife, you wait to use it for the first time on Rosh Hashanah as a skula for a shidduch. He and his friends tried it, and they all got engaged this year. I would say, afal pikein. My mom will call you 2 days before Rosh Hashanah to remind you to use it, but hold on to it. Now, my friend honestly means well, but we've had the discussion before about skulas and tefillah and about how these things work. She personally really wanted to get married, tried every skula in the book, like what? What? Oh, that's what I would have thought, going to Amukah. Like cutting her hair an inch shorter than she normally would. Any idea? I have no idea. And
they like having long hair. It's like the biggest
mysterious nefesh. So to show that it's a mysterious nefesh. Okay. And now she's engaged. So she just thought because it worked for her, in quotes, then she would help us out too. You know, it's always good for someone who just gets engaged and married to take care of their friends. So this is how, instead of setting them up with nice boys, this woman decided that the way to take care of her friends is to give them a beaded knife and tell them not to use it till Rosh Hashanah. If we wouldn't take the knife, though, she would potentially get upset, have her feelings hurt, get frustrated with us. There also wouldn't be any way to deter her from the possibility that skulas don't work. So, number one, are we obligated to blatantly refuse a skula in an outright manner? Number two, if not blatantly refused, should we take the knife and throw it out? Number three, can we use the knife regularly, tovel it, and not waste it, or is it considered an avodah zarah? Number four, what should we do to prepare for the upcoming wedding, which will include jewelry given out, challah, wine, etc., etc.? I assume she means all these things being used in a non-conventional fashion. Because most weddings have challah and wine and, you know, and etc. Number five, out of curiosity, is there any mention of this skula anywhere? Okay, so that was skula shayla number two. Skula shayla number three has come up several times, but my favorite one was the following email from a married woman who is pregnant, and she sends the following. My friend who does not yet have children asked me to accompany her to the mikveh and dip with her because it's a skula for her to have kids. Do I need to do a full bath and normal mikveh preparations prior to going along with my friend to the mikveh? That was her
shayla.
Yeah,
a number of times.
So, what? Well, no, this was the time where I got the question about do I need to do khafifa? But normally it's, you know, like, is this a thing? Should I do this? Do I need to count Shiva Nikiyim first? There's a lot of, you know, do I need to do bedikos? Do I need to, like, they're not sure, you know, do I say a bracha? Do I not say a bracha? How many times do I dip? You know, what exactly are the parameters of this this tevila, shel chesed or whatever? So, in order to answer all of these questions, let's just maybe like back up and talk about skulas for a little bit. What I'm going to share with you is what I've heard many, many times from Mori Varabi, Rav Shechter Shlita, and then we'll come back toward the end and we'll just like actually deal with the questions and we'll answer the questions at hand, what these particular skulas might be based on and where something might have been lost in translation or in transmission through the generations, and whether, you know, and how to answer these questions. So first of all, Rav Shechter often points out, when the Torah was given, the world didn't know much about science and was fairly unsophisticated in a lot of ways. So there was tons of superstition in the world. And no matter how much people give up on all sorts of religion and, you know, give up on all sorts of observance, somehow superstition has a way of sticking. People tend to like to really buy into superstition. And the Torah says specifically, especially in light of the fact that, you know, superstition tends to survive through the generations and the Torah is timeless, but it was particularly pertinent at the time of Kabbalah's Torah. The Torah says a specific issue, that you're not allowed to practice superstitions. What's the difference between those two isurim? So lo sanachshu nichush is that something happens and a person takes it as a simin that he should or should not do something, even though b'derech hateva it makes absolutely no sense. So you're trying to make a decision in life. So if a you know, black cat crosses your path, if a red car drives down the block right now, so that's going to make your decision. That's a simin min hashamayim that you're supposed to do this. So that's, but the red car driving down the block has absolutely nothing to do with whether you should invest in that stock or whether you should marry this girl or whether you should, you know, take this job or whatever the decision a person is facing in life. So that's an issa d'oraisa of nichush. The Gemara, they had something that sounds a little similar to it. The Gemara says that they would ask a child every once in a while, psokli psukech, tell me a pasuk. And the child would zug a pasuk, he would say what he learned, and they would take that as a simon. So apparently there is some sort of exception, Rav Shechter points out, to use Torah Shebichsav as a way of guiding a person. This is what's often called, we don't have Pesokli Pesukeich anymore, but we have what's, people in more recent generations did what's called the Goral Agra. There's a famous story that Rav Aaron Cutler did that when he decided, when he was deciding where to go when leaving Europe, and he opened up the Chumash and he found the pasuk that I forgot which pasuk it was, but a pasuk that tells Aaron to go greet Moshe Rabbeinu. So it says Ve'yom La'Aaron, you know, Lecha Moshe, or whatever. I don't remember the pasuk, but go to Moshe. And he said, "Wow, Rav Moshe Feinstein was ready in America, and here's a pasuk that says Aaron go to Moshe." So he decided to come to America, and the rest is history. Lakewood Yeshiva has, I don't know, 10,000 bachrim or whatever learning Yom V'Laila. It's unbelievable. So fantastic. So there is apparently some sort of exception of using psukim of Torah. Now, there is no sort of exception for using any other book. Not Mishnais, not Gemaras, not anything else. Rav Shechter always tells the story that once when he was in Tannersville for the summer, there's a group of Hasidim there that have a minhag. They like to use the sefer of their Rebbe's igros, of the letters of the Rebbe, that they, whenever they have to make a decision, they open up to a random page, they stick a piece of paper in it, close the book, and the next day they open it up again, they look where the paper was stuck, and they read, and they use that as advice for their specific situation. And he said that a woman was telling him that she couldn't find the Rebbe's igros, and they had to make a decision. The son didn't want to go to summer camp that year. He wasn't sure if he should go back to summer camp or come with the family to Tannersville. So they didn't know what to do, so she just took one of her cookbooks. And she opened up the cookbook, and she stuck in the piece of paper, and she checked the next day, and it was right there on the page of blueberry pie. And she only makes blueberry pie in Tannersville. It was obvious that the child was supposed to spend the summer in Tannersville. So he just pointed out, it's no more ridiculous than the Rebbe's igros. Meaning, it's no... either one is a violation of nichush. It has nothing to do with anything. We're just opening up some random books and using that. That's how we make decisions in life. He thought either one is nisa d'oraisa. On Rosh Hashanah, another possible exception, on Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara tells us about eating various simanim. But the Nesivos explains it's not really a violation. It's not that when I eat the date that it's going to be Tamas Sonenu. I forgot which one, right? Tamari Tamas Sonenu. When I eat whatever Shiyur Bezuchu Yosenu Kariman, when I eat the pomegranate, it's not that the eating of the thing is what causes it. And Asivas points out that the Ramban Chumash writes that if you look at in the Nevi'im, the way the Nevi'im react to different things, the way the Nevi'im give over their Nevu'ah, there are two modes of giving over a Nevu'ah. Some give over a Nevu'ah without any physical manifestation of what they're talking about, without any demonstration of what they're saying. They just say, here's the Nevu'ah. Others have a physical, you know, the valley of dry bones. There's physical demonstration of what they're actually talking about. And the Ramban writes that when there's a physical demonstration, it's a guarantee that the prophecy is going to happen. So the Nesiva says maybe the same is true with tefillah. That a person offers a tefillah, so it's one level of tefillah. But if you offer a tefillah accompanied by some sort of demonstration about how deeply you are feeling that tefillah right now, about how deep your kavanos are in that tefillah, so maybe that physical demonstration elevates the tefillah. So the simanim, says the Nesivus, it's not about the simen, it's not about eating the rimon, it's not about eating the various simanim. No, what it's about is the tefillah. The whole inyan is the yehi ratzon that you say along with it. The yehi ratzon sheyitam sonenu, the yehi ratzon sheyir bezuchu yoseinu kareem, yehi ratzon. And we accompany that with a physical demonstration, hoping that the pol dimyon strengthens the tefillah, but the tefillah is really the ikar, because Jews believe in tefillah. We do. We don't believe that that's a superstition. We believe in tefillah. Shem Tov points out that our religion is the least superstitious of all religions, but somehow Jews tend to be the most superstitious people. And it's really against our religion to be superstitious. That's the issue of Nichush. What's the Sa'onin? What does it mean to be Ma'onin? What does that mean? So the Gemara says that means, the Gemara in Sanhedrin discusses, says that means that a person believes that there are lucky times. That there are certain times that are lucky, you know, Friday the 13th, that is a bad time and a scary time, and then there are good times. There's only one exception that we know of to that rule, and that is what the Gemara tells us in Maseches Tainis. Mishnah says in Maseches Tainis that Mishnah Nichnas Av Mematin Besimcha, and the Gemara says, Kshem Shemishnah Nichnas Av Mematin Besimcha, Kach Mishnah Nichnas Adar Marbin Besimcha. Now, what does that mean? So the Gemara tells us what it means. It means that someone who has a din together against a guy, you have a court case against a guy, a person, if he has the ability to decide when it's going to be, so as far, insofar as it relates to a conflict or a confrontation between a Jew and a non-Jew, we try to avoid having that in Av, or really just the first 9 days of Av, the way most poskim understand. Some poskim understand until Tu B'Av, but Pashtus, the first 9 days of Av. And instead, we try to have it during Chodesh Adar, because Zman—that's Zman Geula, Yemei Nisma, Yili Yisrael, Purim Pesach. Rashi writes in Maseches Tainis, that's when the period of Geula really begins, the period of Nisan really begins. That's a very, very powerful time. So, generally speaking, we're not supposed to believe that there is a mazel, but specifically in the area of a confrontation between a Jew and a non-Jew, we try to relate to Adar and keep it away from Av. Rav Shachta thought that even as far as scheduling a surgery, that someone asked him once, he said that a non-Jewish doctor that was going to do a surgery and on a Jewish child, and he thought that, and the person said, should we not schedule it during the 9 days? He said, no, it's about a confrontation between a Jew and a non-Jew. The non-Jewish doctor wants to help you. They're not trying to kill you. They want to... When you have a court case, it's you against them. So then you don't want to schedule that. But when the non-Jew is helping you, he didn't think that was an issue. One could argue that it's a separate issue, that it's not about the non-Jew issue, it's just about doing dangerous things. That because the mother, one should try to stay away from things that are inherently dangerous. Rav Shach didn't think so. He didn't think there was any reason to postpone the surgery. But okay, one could argue that maybe for dangerous things, a separate issue. So there is a minag, quoted by the Rishonim, and Mukhe Yosef quotes, in the Sech Sanhedrin, about scheduling a wedding at the beginning of the month. And it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch. Why would you schedule a wedding at the beginning of the month? Because that's when the moon is still expanding, it's still growing, and it's a simen that the love between the chasen and kala should continue to grow. So you want while the moon is growing, not while the moon is shrinking. So the Mukhe Yosef asked the kashya. He has a havamina that this should be asur. They used to dafka insist that a wedding, not that it's asur to get married at the beginning of the month, but to insist that you have to try to schedule a dafka at the beginning of the month because you think it means something. No, it doesn't mean anything. So the Mukhe Yosef ultimately says, it's mutter, but not because you think that it actually causes anything, it actually helps anything. But it's not, it's a simen tov, it's a nice simen, meaning a lamashal. A kala wears a white dress. Why does a kala wear a white dress? Because it's a simen of purity that she wears a white dress. So if she wears a blue dress, does it mean she's impure? No, it doesn't mean she's going to be impure, she's going to be unfaithful. No, it's just, it's nice to wear something that's a symbol of purity. It's nice to wear to do things that are symbolic of good things. So he said that's the pshat, that the idea is that you do things that are simple, but when going up against other cheshbonos, you're going to delay the wedding 5 months because all the dates early in the month are taken for the next 5 months, and you don't want to get married at the end. No, the chas v'shalom. What gives us the right to be mivatel mitzvah puravu for 5 months, to be mivatel, to go through the agony of being engaged for that much longer? No, of course you'd want to get married sooner rather than later. Shatz pointed out that in Reb Tzin Meiselman's biography. There's a copy of the wedding invitation from when Ramosha Soloveitchik got married, and there are a few things interesting about the invitation. One interesting thing about the invitation is it's on the bottom it says the parents' names, and it said Chaim I forgot the wife's name, but it said her actual name. That's so Chaim Soloveitchik never would have been Mekubal in Lakewood today, or in Brooklyn today. You can't write the wife's name. It's not Sneers. He writes the wife's name. But Ruchaim didn't know. He didn't know that it wasn't Sneers. So they wrote the wife's name. But the other interesting thing was that they got married at the end of a month. He must have not realized that either. They got married at the end of a month. So you see that this wasn't something that they were so makbid about. Rav Teichtal, in his Shuvas Mishnah Sachi, he has said he's most known for Sefer Ema Bar Smicha. That's he was originally like a Satmar Chassid, and he, through the whole Holocaust, he was coming to the realization that we had to reassess everything, reassess the whole attitude toward the Medina and toward establishing a Medina. There wasn't a Medina yet, but toward establishing a Medina and toward the idea of Zionism. So he wrote a famous Sefer Ema Bar Smicha, which he wrote completely from memory, which is unbelievable. If you read it, it's very fascinating. I would recommend, if you ever read Ema Bar Smicha, read Vayol Moshe and Ema Bar Smicha in proximity to each other. And note the differences are obvious, but note the similarities in just style of learning. It's like, the Hasidic style of learning. It's like one takes that style and uses it this way, the other one takes it and uses it this way. Very, very interesting. But his tshuvas aren't so Hasidic. His tshuvas are pretty, regular tshuvas. And in his tshuvas, he writes that there never was a minik dafka to insist on getting married at the beginning of the month. The chiddush of the Gaonim, that these Rishonim, that the Menucha Yosef quotes, is that you're allowed to, it's permissible to take that into the cheshbon. To have that as a siman tov, that it's mutter to do that you're allowed to arrange to try for the beginning of the month as a siman tov, and that's not a violation of lo sa'un, that's all. So those are two of the fundamental isurim. Then there's also an isur of chukas akum, which we've discussed on several occasions over here. Not everything that the goyim do is necessarily usur. Rav Shachar used to always give the example that the French may have invented French fries, but it doesn't mean that it's us to eat French fries, because they're delicious. So if there's a good reason why people would do it, so then it's not a violation of Chukas Akum. I remember vividly sitting in Shir, and he gave the example. He said, Jews used to wear the long black coats, and the Goyim invented these ideas, a short jacket. So he said, but it makes sense. It's much easier to sit down in a short jacket than in a long black coat. He said, but a tie. He said, a tie really makes no sense. So he held up his tie. He said, tie luchar is Chukas Akum. What does that even mean? I mean, on other occasions he told us that since that's how we show respect and we dress respectfully, so people should insist on wearing a tie for davening. That, instead of wearing a gartel out of respect for davening, he said he once saw a guy realized that he didn't have a gartel, so he took off his tie and he tied it around as a gartel. So, no, it's the opposite. The tie is a better way of showing respect. So for a while there was a tkufa in YU where a bunch of guys were wearing ties for Tuesday mincha, at every tefillah, because Rav Shachar let that slip in a shir or something. But eventually everything went back to normal. The, the uh, so so is in general, we always have to look at what the science says. Is there a reason why some practice that we're going to do is going to work? Scientifically, we see that something works as a refuah, even though we don't understand. I don't understand why when I pop an Advil, it makes my headache go away. I don't know, maybe it's placebo effect, but probably there's something scientifically that's happening. And I don't understand it, but it's proven, and it's apparently scientifically proven, so we trust it. So that's what the Rambam rejected many of the medical suggestions of the Gemara. The Rambam doesn't quote, because the Gemara was going with the best science that they had of their time, and nowadays we have better science. So if a person wants to do brain surgery, I don't recommend that you open up a Gemara Ksuvus and read where to put the leeches to, as you're about to cut open the person's skull. Probably not the best idea, because we have a little bit more advanced ways of doing these things nowadays, and therefore we should, for example, the Gemara says that not to eat fish and meat. So these people are pretty makpid about it, because the later poskim aren't sure. They're not sure. Magen Avraham says, what do you have to worry about fish and meat? Nothing to worry about anymore. I remember when the first Susie Fishbane cookbook came out. What's it called? You guys aren't married. Right, so one of those kosher, maybe it was kosher by design, the first one came out, there was a recipe for spinach veal thing that called for Worcestershire sauce, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Now, Worcestershire sauce is made with fish. So that was a big shayla. Everyone was asking the shayla, how can you use that on the veal? The veal is meat and it's fish and meat. So it turns out that if it's just as a good idea to have, that if it doesn't say OU fish on the package, if it just says a regular OU, it means it's batel b'shishin. Elamai is machlokas shach and taz, whether sakana could be batel b'shishin. Isser is batel b'shishin. Machlokas shach taz with sakana is batel b'shishin. The OU takes the position that if you want to be machmer, you'll read the ingredients yourself. Otherwise, they're not writing OU fish. They're going to rely that it's batel b'shishin. Plus, Magen Avraham holds that there's nothing to be worried about anyway nowadays. He says for hundreds of years, we haven't seen anyone get sick from eating meat and fish together, so we're not so makbid nowadays. Rosh Hashanah is not makbid about this at all. I remember the first time he was just at my house this past Shabbos. First time he was at my house for Shabbos, my in-laws were there. So when my in-laws were there, my father-in-law likes to have a l'chaim on Shabbos, so he offered Rosh Hashanah l'chaim after the fish. So, because that's the minhag, because you have a l'chaim to wash your mouth between the fish and the meat. So he took the l'chaim, he went in Rome, so he took the l'chaim. So I told his son, is he always makbid to have a l'chaim after the fish, before the meat? He says, no, he doesn't even wash off his fork. He uses the same fork for fish and meat. He was just trying to be nice. It was great, because you get him just a little bit, it was fantastic. He was flowing with divrei Torah and stories. He always is, but even more than usual. So the later Achronim discuss, should there be such a thing that we're concerned about fish and meat? So maybe yeah, maybe no. But the concern was that it was dangerous. And Shach always points out, he says, it's amazing. There are people that they wash off the fork and clean it up, make sure they have a different fork, and then it's a ben yomo, whatever, they're makbid with the fish and the meat. But they're chain smokers and they're obese. And what do you think is more dangerous? For real? Is it more dangerous to have the fish and the meat, or more dangerous to behave, to live in such an unhealthy way? Just got my Fitbit this week. Okay, so the Gemara never says anything about how to cut nails. This was an interesting one. Rav Shechter said, the Gemara never says that you should skip nails when you cut. It never says not to cut your fingernails and your toenails on the same day. That's all later that we have such minhagim. So he said, where do those minhagim come from? I don't know. This I thought was a chiddush. He said probably it came from because they didn't have nail clippers, so they were using like big scissors or knives to cut their nails, and it's not so easy. I remember my grandfather should live and be well. Used to have a store in Rehovot, and he had a helper. He hired whoever was cheapest tire. So he hired this really old retired Israeli guy, and the problem was the customers were chased away by this guy, because he would take off his sandalim, he'd put his foot up on the by the cash register, take out a giant scissor and start cutting his nails, his toenails. So Zaidi, maybe that's not the best guy to be the first person to see when you walk into the store. So if when people would cut their nails that way, he could cut it. He was using fabric scissors. You could cut off a toe. So you need to really concentrate on what you're doing. So Rav Shach thought, what's the best way to increase concentration? First of all, don't cut all 20 nails at once, because you're gonna have fatigue is gonna set in, and you're gonna cut off one of your toes. Second of all, he says, if you don't do it in order, so you have to pay attention to how you're doing it. Just by adding a little bit of something to focus on, it will increase your focus. I thought that was an interesting pshat in the fingernails. That's what he suggested. And then people sometimes get confused. The issue of ayin hara. Ayin hara is a totally separate issue. Ayin hara is something that is the Gemara talks about it, and anami zara di Yosef kasina, that anyone comes from zara di Yosef is not lo shalpe ayin hara, that ayin bisha is not subject to ayin hara. Ayin hara has nothing to do with like shadim or like anything. Ayin hara is a totally different issue. What ayin hara means, Rashi in Parshat Mishpatim says that we have to be very careful how we treat an alman of the yasom, because kitzakim elai, that they cry out to Hakadosh Baruch Hu. That's what the psukim say. So Rashi comments that you're punished for mistreating really anybody, not just the yasom v'almana, but it's Hakadosh Baruch Hu memahar lipara from someone who mistreats yasom v'almana. Why? Because someone who mistreats yasom v'almana causes them to cry out to Hashem that they're hurt by this. They're more hurt by it, and they're going to cry out to Hashem. It's going to be a tefillah to Hakadosh Baruch Hu that you should suffer for causing them this hurt. So that's ayin hara. Ayin hara is that you're going to cause other people to look at you when you're successful, when you have to post your every success on Facebook and your every moment of joy and happiness. So we see what happens, that it causes other people to be depressed. Look, I go on Facebook and everyone else's life is so happy. It's something my mother-in-law always says whenever we whenever she sees relatives in Israel, they have little kids. So she says, she's always looking at the posts of the little children. She says, these are such happy children. They're always smiling. Like, Mom, they're not posting the pictures of the kids when they're crying. They're only posting the pictures of the kids when they're smiling. But that's the impression people get, that like everyone else has such a happy life, such an amazing life. Look at that, they're smiling, they're on vacation, they're here, they're, everything's so happy. They don't know, they don't see the kids fighting in the car for 4 hours on the way, driving to the vacation. They only see the happy picture in front of the castle or whatever. They don't see so you get the impression that everyone has such a better life than me, and people feel a sense of jealousy, and that sense of jealousy is what causes HaKadosh Baruch Hu to say, let's even score a little bit over here. You're causing these people to be upset because of your joy. So that's what ayin hara is, that a person, so what's the teretz to ayin hara? So we all know, a right to bendel. No, that's what the Tosefta says, Beferish HaMesech HaShabbos is Darkei Amori. That's not the Jewish way of dealing with it. That doesn't come from Jewish sources. That comes from non-Jewish sources. To put a red string on that. The red string is beferish in the Tosefta, that's not from Jewish sources. So what is the way of dealing with ayin hara? So the Gemara says that first of all, v'atznei alechas v'mashem alkecha, a person should live a life of tznius, not draw attention to themselves, not be so, it's like to drive the fanciest car and put a red ribbon around it so that it won't be subject to ayin hara. Maybe drive the less fancy car, maybe not draw attention always to our every success, and also to have a profound sense of Ein Od Milvado. Nefesh Chaim develops the idea to believe deeply and focus on the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world, and that everything that happens is because of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Rav Shachta tells the story about how Rav Amram Bloy, Zichrono Levracha, was the father of the Pisrei Choshen, his big Neturi Kartanik, Rav Amram Bloy. So Rav Amram was a big tzaddik. Rav Amram Bloy, also, not that because he's a Neturi Kartanik. So Rav Amram Bloy once used to daven Marv by the Briska Rav on Matzoy Shabbos, every Matzoy Shabbos. So he went to the Briska Rav, daven Marv, and Briska Rav says, how's Rav Zelig Bengis doing? Rav Ruven Zelig Bengis was the head of the Eid Haredis in his time, at the same time as Rav Kook. Have you heard of Rav Bengis? Big gong. He was a big, super-duper genius. They just published his Haggadah. Fantastic. Beautiful, beautiful Haggadah. Anyone here learning Yeshiva HaKotel? No Yeshiva HaKotel? His Rav Zelig Bengis' great-grandson is Rav Ruven Zelig Taragin, Kevi Taragin, great-grandson of Rav Bengis. They're not exactly the same, but Rav Bengis was from the Eid HaRedis, and both very big Talmid Chacham, and Rav Bengis was very, very old. So the Briska Rav says, how's Rav Bengis doing? And Rav Amram Bloy said, not well. So the Brisk Rav got all upset. He said, I knew it because every time I asked someone, last time I asked someone I was doing, he said, everyone's talking about how it's unbelievable. He's so old and yet he's so strong and he's so good and he's so this. So he said, I knew it was an ayin hara that everyone's drawing attention to that success. So I knew something was about to happen. So Rav Loi said, as a saying that we should, once we believe that, that will ward off the ayin hara. And the Brisk Rav got very upset at him. Don't just throw around Einod Milvado like it's a nothing. And Brisk Rav explained to people afterwards that Einod Milvado is something that it's a deep kavana that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world. It doesn't work as like a skula. Say Einod Milvado, and then the Ayin Hara goes away. No, it means that we focus on the fact that all of these schools don't work. That it's all about that there's a Ribbono Shel Olam that runs the world, and that's what we're supposed to focus on. Brisk Rav said that when he was running away, when the Nazis took over Brisk, he happened to have been out of town. It was his son Rav Beryl, and they were on a train somewhere, and there were Nazi officers on the train, and they were hoping they can get back to Brisk without incident. And they decided they can sit and focus, like Nefesh HaChaim says, you know, Mavado, it's all in Kadosh Baruch Hu's hands, all in Kadosh Baruch Hu's hands, and they were having Kavan for that the entire time, strengthening their emuna, and somehow they were able to, the Nazis didn't notice them. How did you not notice the Brisk Rav with the beard and pace and everything? Didn't notice them. And then when they were getting close to Brisk and they saw the forest right outside of Brisk, they said, okay, we're getting close. And they sort of let up a little bit, and all of a sudden someone started questioning them, and things got intense for them until they focused again, meaning it's a focus on the Ribbono Shel Olam. Not as a school, you focus on the Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world, so you dive into the Ribbono Shel Olam because you know that it's all within his control. So that's what tefillah is all about. And a lot of these things that we have are really just ways of motivating tefillah. So let's discuss some of the famous skulas. Say, folding a talis after Shabbos is a skula for Shalom Bayis. So why do people fold talis after Shabbos? I'm not going to discuss it for too long. There are really two reasons. One is the skula for Shalom Bayis and whatever else it involves, shaking out the shadim and whatever else. And the other is that because people don't want to fold something on the creases on Shabbos, because that might be some sort of Isra Shabbos. So that's a separate issue. Happens to be my Shabbos talis, I don't know why, but it doesn't have any creases. I'm zocha to a nace. My Shabbos talis has no creases. So I don't have the Shabbos issue, just the skula issue. So Rav Shechter thought, why is that a skula, folding talis after Shabbos? Because if you leave it, they didn't want to fold it on Shabbos because of the Shabbos issue. So if you don't fold it after Shabbos, then it's just lying around unfolded. And when you leave your clothing around unfolded, your wife gets upset. So a skula for Shalom Bayis is fold your clothing and put it away instead of leaving it out. That's what he thought the big skula was. He said that someone was by the Satmar Rebbe once, and he was staying in shul long after Shabbos, and he was makbid to fold his talis, and he was folding it and refolding it, that it should be just perfect, and go over and over again, like a real OCD kind of way. And the Satmar Rebbe, who himself, was sort of OCD in this kind of way, said to him, this is ridiculous, what are you doing? And the guy said, I'm having Shalom Bayis issues, and school for Shalom Bayis, I want to make sure I do it just right. So I'm Rebbe said, you know what else is school for Shalom Bayis? Going home and helping your wife do the dishes after Shabbos, that's probably also school for Shalom Bayis. The whole folding the talis is just school in the sense that you're just being neat, you're cleaning up your clothing. We ask Rav Shechter many times about Shlissel Challah. He said his wife came home once and decided that it was told by the Rebbetzin in the community that they should make Shlissel Challah. He said, don't you dare put a key in our challah. It's mamish nichush and this is our raisa. Where does it come from? So the Gemara in Tainis says that there are three keys that HaKadosh Baruch Hu keeps completely to himself, that no one else has a koch over. HaKadosh Baruch Hu keeps completely within his jurisdiction. And one of them is the key of Parnasa. So the idea of the Shlissel Challah was that the key of Parnasa is a reminder that it's completely in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that should be a poel dimyon to encourage tefillah, that everything is in the hands of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the less cynical version of where it comes from. The more cynical version of where it comes from is Easter breads. Pesach is around the time of Easter, and there's a much older custom than Shlissel Challah, that they would make, that Christians would make breads with a cross in it, the shape of a cross in their breads for Easter, and the old keys were shaped more or less like a cross. So that's the more cynical version of where it comes, but wherever it comes from, to just say, I'm going to put a key in my challah and now it's going to be parnasa, and you forget about the whole point. The whole point is the tefillah. The whole point is that you're supposed to be davening for parnasa because you know that it's all in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands, because the whole key is only in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands. That's what it's really, that's if it's supposed to be about anything, that's what it's really all about. School is saying Parshas HaKetoros every day, also same idea. Parshas HaKetoros being a sandik, all of this is to motivate tefillah. The Ketoros itself is a school of Rashiras, Pasuk Baruch Hashem Chela, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to give us wealth. So we want to spread the wealth. That's why the Mishnah says in Yuma, they would say that Chadashim L'Ketoros Bo, that anyone who hasn't done Ketoros before should come do Ketoros now so that they can spread the wealth. But so saying the Parshas HaKetoros and Sandikos, it relates to the fact that the Medrash says that being a Sandik is like being Makter Ketoros. So that's what they say, the Gra and others always wondered. I've been a Sandik so many times, I still haven't become wealthy, I don't buy the whole school. Okay? Others say, no, but Hasidim, they say, it doesn't say you can become wealthy with money. The Gra had plenty of wealth. He was wealthy with Torah, he was wealthy with other things. Okay. The more recent vintage Minag is getting mezuzahs checked when there's a problem, or a ksuba checked by a makubal, and not checked to see if there's halachically a problem. You have problems in the house, so it could be you're not doing the mitzvah mezuzah properly. You have to check all your mitzvahs to make sure you're doing the mitzvahs properly. So you go to a sofer to check the mezuzah, to make sure that the mezuzah, if you never had them checked properly. But to go to a makubal who's going to look at your ksuba, and he's going to say, oh no, you can't have that name now, change the name right away, rip up the ksuba and change your name, change your wife's name, and write a new ksuba. So that's terrible, because that's halachically very problematic. Both the mezuzah one and the ksuba one. Why? Because if someone insists, they go to a mekubal to check their mezuzah. So they can go to Eretz Yisrael, so they'll take all the mezuzahs from their house, and go to Eretz Yisrael. They're leaving their house without a mezuzah. That's a bitul mitzvah saseh every single second, that they're leaving their house without a mezuzah. Unnecessarily. If you need a check, so you have someone come check as quickly as you can. They're going to be away for three weeks, and for a month in Eretz Yisrael. Why leave the house without a mezuzah? That's terrible. You can't do that. By the ksuba, it's a bigger problem. Because by the ksuba, you can't just change a person's name and then write it in the ksuba. It's not them. It has to be kavua that's their name. How you kaveya the new name, it has to be in use for 30 days already. But what do these mekubalim do? They'll rip up the ksuba right away and write a new ksuba. So you use that ksuba, so you're violating the isser. The Gemara ksuba says that it's an isser to stay with your wife without a ksuba. You don't have a kashrut ksuba in the house if that's your ksuba. So that's also a terrible thing, that they do such things. There's a tshuva in the Shilas Tshuva's Binyan Av, Chelek Gimel Ebenezer Simin Nun Zayin, Rabin Tzion Abba Shaul. Writes in a tshuva like this, that it's a terrible thing. These people, these mekubalim, that check the ksubas and no halachic basis, they go and they convince people, oh, this is the reason you're having shalom bayis problems. Because this name, that name, that's what the shalom bayis problems are all about. So Rav Bakshi Daron writes at the end of that tshuva that he heard from one of these people that Rav Vosner gave a skama to this person. So he has printed in this tshuva that he sent a letter to Rav Vosner. The letter that he wrote to Rav Vosner, Zichron Levracha, is printed in the tshuvas, and Rav Vosner's response is printed. And Rav Vosner writes that I've clarified what these people do. Ve'ein das chachamim noche emenu. That this is not correct. Rav Vosner says, milvad b'ksuba shenimtzu b'psul al pi alacha. Unless you find a psul in the ksuba al pi alacha, that there's a problem. Lasus ksuba dishtakach b'psulta. Then you have a whole nusach of what you write. You write a nusach of a ksuba that you found a psul. To put these thoughts in people's head that what's happening to them is because of their ksuba, chas v'shalom. No, your job is to tell people to do tshuva, meisim tovim. Not, oh, it has nothing to do with your mitzvahs, meisim tovim. It has to do with the fact that your wife's name is Shira and I don't like the name Shira. Rip it up. No, nothing. You have to more people tshuva meisim tovim. Kfar shalachti lo daiti b'zek kam upam. And he says, as far as this guy, I've already sent him many times what I think about it, says Rav Vosner. V'kanir ukanira humi sug kazeh she'inu tzayis. He says, it seems that he's from this kind of person that just doesn't listen. So what do you want me to do? I already sent him what I think. So now going back to our questions. What does this all have to do? That was the questions that we started with. Since I got this, I don't know. Okay, 5 minutes. So going back to our questions. The neder about Tashma Shemita. So is it something that you need to be matter neder? Do we say the whole thing is a skula that's an avera? What do you mean? Nichush? So l'chor, it's a neder of a mitzvah. because giving tzedakah anytime you do anything is a mitzvah. As my brother said, in only the way he could say, he says, if you take a neder, you're going to give tzedakah every bowel movement. That too is a neder of a mitzvah. It's no more meaningful maybe than this, but it's also a neder of a mitzvah. So it requires hataras nedarim. It's a real neder. It's something that's meaningful. I thought when I first heard it that it's very Christian sounding. Ki'ilu, you need a kapara for every tashmish shemitah. We hold it's a mitzvah. You don't need a kapara. You need to give a kapara every time. So I thought, Rav Shachter said, no. Rav Shachter said, there's a minna called the Mishbura, that when a woman lights candles, that she should give tzedakah before she lights Shabbos candles. Why? Because Azar bin Ner, the Gemara says in Shabbos Chav Gimel, having no banim talmidei chacham, you have children of talmidei chacham when you're Azar bin Ner. So when you want to be mechazik, that mitzvah that's going to be a school of Rabbanim Talmid Chacham. Why is that a school of Rabbanim Talmid Chacham? That one appears in the Gemara. So likely because Ner relates to Shalom Bayis, the same Gemara in Shabbos says, and Ner Shabbos, Ner Chanuk, and Ner Shabbos Adif, because of Shalom Bayis, having light in the house leads to a more tranquil home environment where people aren't tripping over each other, and having a healthy home environment is a big school to have well-adjusted children who are going to listen to the way you try to raise them. So that's probably why it's the school of Rabbanim Talmid Chacham, also because a woman who's Zari bin Ner, that's normally when a woman davens. So that's when she davens for her children. So she's very careful by Ner Shabbos to light in time and to have enough time to offer the tefillos. So then her tefillos will be more hurt. But the Mishmura says, give tzedakah. So Shach said, what do you think is a better school to have for children? Mitzvahs Ner Shabbos or mitzvahs Ona? So whichever one, you're mechazik with tzedakah. So he says, okay, makes sense. They're mechazik with tzedakah by giving tzedakah. Okay, I don't know. It still sounded a little funny to me. It requires a Torah Sazarim. So the halach is, if you know what you're being matir neder for, you have to, one member of the Beis Din has to know what it's for. You don't need to be mefarid to all three of them. So if Shachter said, if the guy's embarrassed, send him to YU and I'll pull over to other rabbis and I'll know and the other two won't know. Mistama, he'd be embarrassed to tell from Shachter. So I said, you know, let him come to me. I didn't see why it's so embarrassing. If he had to be mefarid, how many times or whatever, you know, or how much money, maybe that. I didn't see why this would be so embarrassing. Okay. What about the knife situation? So if you Google it, in Sichos Haran, Rav Nassim Mibraslov quotes from his teacher Rav Nachman Mibraslov, who in turn refers to a tradition from his great grandfather, the Baal Shem Tov, that a knife should never be given as a present, because for whatever reason, knife should never be given as a present because it's passing on danger, something bad. Knife should never be given as a present. So we're passing on your own success and giving it away, giving it up. That's the opposite, no? So they quote from another grandson of the Baal Shem Tov that does not mention not to give the knife as a present. Not only that, in a letter to someone else, he says, please accept from me this gift, a beautiful silver knife. So apparently something got lost in the transmission of that one. But the Chayzim of Lublin, apparently it's said, would distribute knives to his Hasidim on Rosh Hashanah as a school of four wealth, not Shiduchim. So why? Because Chotei Chayim L'Kol Chai. On Rosh Hashanah, Kodesh Baruch Hu is Chotei Chayim L'Kol Chai. So Chotei, so your knife is Chotei, cuts life. So it's a way of motivating such a tefillah that Kodesh Baruch Hu should be Chotei Chayim L'Kol Chai. A little bit strange to assume that the knife is going to be so everything's lost. The whole tefillah is lost. The whole making yourself better, a better person, do more mitzvahs and ma'asim tovim and chesed. No, just use the knife. Use the knife for the first time Rosh Hashanah. So the girl had a lot of questions though. Can she take the knife? I don't see why not. You know, someone gives you a knife, you're allowed to take the knife. I don't think it's the desire to take the knife. Does she have to confront her friend again about schoolers? Apparently she had this conversation. I don't think she has to confront her friend again. Is she allowed to use the knife regularly, tovel it and use it regularly? I think so, but probably not till Rosh Hashanah, because if someone gives you a gift al tanai, so the whole gift is only al tanai. You probably have to follow the tanai, midini mamonos, but not because of the skula. But just make sure that you don't believe in this, and that if you get engaged, that you realize it's because of the great zechus you have in not believing in the stupidity that maybe Rosh Hashanah. So, but it's all stupidity. You should realize that. And as far as the mikveh, so I thought the mikveh thing, going with the pregnant woman to the mikveh, that's probably based on the Gemara in Brachos Tav Chaf. The Gemara in Brachos says that Rabbi Yochanan Avragel Davakazel Yosef Hashari Ditvila. Rabbi Yochanan used to sit right by the Shari Ditvila. Why? Omar Kisalkim Benosol Vasim Ditvila Mestaklin Bivanavilu Zarid Shapiru Kavasi. So that when the women come out of the Tvila, the first thing they'll see is Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan was so beautiful, and maybe in that Sechus they'll have such beautiful children like Rabbi Yochanan. So I thought the Gemara sounds like it's saying that the first thing they see when they come out of the mikveh is somehow going to affect what happens later that night. It's somehow going to affect the conceiving a child or whatever. So I thought maybe that's what this minhag is based on. If the first thing the woman sees when she comes out of the mikveh is a big fat pregnant belly, so that will maybe motivate. As Rav Marsha writes in B'Metzia Pei Dalid, that it's like the makalos shel Yaakov Avinu with the tzon. That which one is has machshavos of b'shas zivug is somehow going to affect the nature of the children. That's al pi kabbalah. They used to recommend that people should think divrei Torah b'shas zivug. Chassan and Kala teachers no longer recommend that. It's probably not such a good idea. But they used to recommend al pi kabbalah. Moshe Weinberger tells Chassanim, if you want to be a very holy Jew, so b'shas zivug you could think, thank you Ribbono Shel Olam for creating such a wonderful hana in this world and allowing me to partake of such a wonderful hana. That's as from as you're allowed to be. But he didn't think that you should be thinking Reb Chaim's. But that was the idea that machshavos during. So I thought maybe that's what it was based on. Someone was discussing with me. I was in YU last week, and someone said that in Washington Heights by the mikveh they have a security guard. So there's a room that when you first open the door and you get into the mikveh, so there's a security guard right there, and then you have to wait till you're buzzed in to the next room. That's their security measure. So they want to know about the Yisur Yichud with the security guard. So I was thinking though, is the first person they see when they come out of the mikveh the security guard? It's hardly a Rabbi Yechanan. Remind me of Rabbi Yechanan sitting at Shari Tvila. But there's no. This is not a. This doesn't mean. I don't think this. I don't think such a minug is quoted anywhere. And I think it's a bit of an extension beyond what the Gemara says. What Rabbi Yochanan's kavanas were. Who knows? The ikar is a person should be mispalel. They should be whatever motivates that tefillah. They should be mispalel that they should be zocha to have children. You get brachas from tzaddikim. We believe even a birchas hadyot al tei kala beinecha kal b'chomer a bracha of a great tzaddik. That's a famous story with the Ragachever. Someone came to the Ragachever when he was sitting with another rav and said, "Can you give me a bracha?" And the Ragachever said, "No," and because he wasn't into giving brachas, he was a chassid, but he didn't like giving brachas. So the other rav who was sitting there said, "Rabbeinu." The Gemara says even a birchas hediot, a bracha of an idiot, is al tei kala beinecha, kal v'chomer your bracha. So the Ragachever said, so instead of me giving a bracha with a kal v'chomer, why don't you give a bracha without a kal v'chomer? but we do believe that brachos mean something and all. So go for brachos and daven a lot and do mitzvos and meisim tovim. We have to remember what the Rambam writes in the Akhtama to Perachelik. The Rambam says we have this most beautiful religion that has so much meaning and has so much value and has so much depth. And a bunch of fools take it and they turn it into a silly superstition. And that's not what our religion is about. Our religion is about Zavod Hashem, it's about tefillah, it's about connecting to the Ribbono Shel Olam, it's about things that actually have considerable deep meaning.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. Carvana makes car buying easy. Isn't that right, hun? Dax? Dax?
Sorry. Did you know about this 7-day money-back guarantee?
A week to evaluate seat comfiness, you say?
A week of terrain tests? Yeah, I can test the brake pad resistance at variable speeds.
Make sure all the kids' stuff fits nicely.
Make sure our stuff fits nicely.
Right.
Still need to buy the car. Getting ahead of ourselves here.
Buy your car with Carvana today.